We have two cases today, but before we begin, I'd like to acknowledge that we have Senior Judge Erdman back with us on the bench. Senior Judge Erdman has flown all the way out from Montana to be here today, and we're deeply grateful that he could be here. Now, for those of you who have not had the pleasure of appearing before Senior Judge Erdman, I'd like to just very briefly touch upon some of his accomplishments. On the military side of the house, as a young man, he enlisted in the United States Marine Corps. Later, he joined the Air National Guard and rose to the rank of Colonel 06. On the legal side of the house, he served as an assistant attorney general in Montana, opened his own full-service law firm, was appointed as a justice on the Montana Supreme Court, was designated as a member of the Office of High Representative in Bosnia and Herzegovina, was appointed as Chief Judge of the Bosnian Election Court, and was appointed to this court by President George W. Bush. And as a trivia tidbit, Senior Judge Erdman's mother was elected as the first woman mayor of Great Falls, Montana. So it's a particular pleasure for me to have Senior Judge Erdman here on the bench because I consider him to be my mentor on this court. So welcome, Senior Judge Erdman. Now, our first case today is United States versus Schmidt. Ms. Mitchell, are you prepared to argue on behalf of appellant?
Yes, Your Honor.
Lieutenant Flynn, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the government?
Yes, Your Honor.
Outstanding. Ms. Mitchell, please proceed.
Thank you. Good morning, Chief Judge Olson, members of the court. May it please the court, I am Tammy Mitchell, and together with Lieutenant Megan Horst, we represent the appellant, Sergeant Julian Schmidt. With this court's permission, I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Granted.
Thank you. We are here today because while the lower court's analysis of in the presence of was correct, its analysis of three other issues was incorrect, and they were all related to the mistake of fact. One, the court used the wrong standard of thin evidence instead of some evidence in deciding a mistake of fact instruction was not required. Two, incorrectly tying the mistake of fact to the in the presence of instead of the separate mens rea element of intentionally. And third, an incorrect prejudice analysis that did not factor in the trial counsel's legally incorrect rebuttal argument that physical proximity was good enough to convict. And for these reasons, we ask this court to set aside the findings and sentence and dismiss with prejudice. An instruction on a special defense is required when there is some evidence, regardless of source or credibility, upon which the panel members could rely if they choose. And this is under Hibbard, 58 MJ at 75, and Brown, 43 MJ at 189. And ever since Himes, which was a 1953 case, and looking at the discussion under RCM 920 ECHO, appellate courts have recognized the military judge has an affirmative obligation to instruct on special defenses when reasonably raised by the evidence, regardless of whether a party requests it. So this would be under Clause 3 of RCM 920 ECHO. And so what happens is in assessing whether there was an honest mistake of fact that JMT was asleep, the lower court looked only at appellant's interrogation. And the lower court ignored the other evidence to support that he had an honest mistaken belief JMT was asleep, most notably from JMT himself, testifying that he kept his eyes closed and acted like he was asleep. And that's counsel, at J.A.
Counsel,
yes.
With that argument, it really is predicated on this concept that the child victim had to be aware of the act that was taking place at that time.
Correct, Your Honor. He had to. So it's always been the standard ever since indecent liberties with a child became a crime, and this is going back to Brown through Knowles and then finally in Miller, where this court held there must be physical proximity coupled with awareness.
So let's do a deep dive, so to speak, on that definition. That's the second definition of presence from Black's Law Dictionary. Mm-hmm. And as you indicated, it has the requirement in there of coupled with awareness. And that's a key point in your brief. It's a key point in the lower court's opinion. We mentioned in Miller, a number of lower of CCA cases have cited that. However, and I said this was a deep dive, in that portion of the definition in Black's Law Dictionary, it also contains information in angled brackets. And the preface to Black's Law Dictionary says, material in angled brackets indicates the context in which that particular definition is to be used. And here, coupled with awareness, that particular definition is the agent was in the presence of the principal. Here we don't have an agent-principal relationship. So why doesn't that indicate that the source document itself, Black's Law Dictionary, indicate that that particular definition of presence does not apply in the facts that we have presented here today?
Your Honor, I think in response to that question, I think even going with what the government argues presence means, there is necessarily a sensory connection that leads to awareness. So presence, and going to example, say the cop who must be present in order to arrest someone without a warrant, they have to see something, they have to hear something that leads them to believe there's a crime sufficient to justify an arrest.
Well, you're 100% right. There are certainly instances where presence does require awareness. A good example of that is a will has to be executed in the presence of so many witnesses. Mm-hmm. But my question is, why would this court be required to look to that particular definition as compared to the first definition in Black's or the definitions that appear in the lay dictionaries, the very well-known ones, Oxford English Dictionary, Merriam-Webster's, and so forth, and none of those carries any indication that awareness is required?
Because we have to look at the historical context of indecent liberties with a child, and then also look at cases like, for example, Burkhart, Gold, Anderson, and Stout. So these are all lower court cases that considered indecent liberties when there was a child who was sleeping or unconscious. And the purpose of the statute is of indecent liberties is to protect the child from harm, which a sleeping child does not have the sensory connection to be exposed to that kind of harm.
Well, I would note, I want to say up front, it is a different statute. But in United States versus Neal, which is a Sixth Circuit case, they said, quote, even if a minor is unaware of the masturbation, perhaps because the child is asleep, such conduct creates serious risks anyway, because the child could wake up or find out about it after the fact. Are there any parallels we should be drawing there?
Your Honor, no, because when Congress changed the statute from indecent liberties to the lewd act upon a child, and that's on the JA-37, the old indecent liberties is the new lewd act upon a child, and then the old indecent acts with another is the new indecent conduct under Article 134 UCMJ, which was not in effect at the time for Sergeant Schmidt. But the idea that it would be enough for an accused to be aware of a child's presence and take a risk that the child would wake up, that goes to the mens rea element of intentionally. And as we pointed out in our reply brief, to just draw that parallel reduces the mens rea to, you know, a reckless standard, which when you look at the definition of intentionally, the accused must desire the resulting harm to the child through the exposure of indecent conduct. And because a child who is asleep, again, lacks that sensory connection, either sight or sound, and therefore lacks awareness of the conduct, at most, it would just be simply indecent conduct. So a child who's not aware cannot experience the harm contemplated by the statute. Whereas indecent conduct, it doesn't matter because the presence of the child is not required for that particular offense.
Counsel, can I back you up to talk about the waiver forfeiture issue? And it seems to me in your brief that you think we have to overrule the 2020 Davis case in order for you to prevail. Is that correct?
Either overrule it or to at least clarify the phrase that was used in the 2020 Davis decision. This court coined a phrase, affirmative acquiescence. So you have affirmative, which means an active act, and then acquiescence is a passive. So to lower the standard to an active passive act is a contradiction in terms, and that's why it needs to be a waiver. It needs to be a forfeiture as opposed to a waiver. And
let me ask on that: would this not be affirmative in this case, where it repeatedly said that he was happy with the instruction? Trial defense counsel said that they were happy with the instructions and that they didn't request any additional instructions. Is that affirmative?
No, Your Honor. The defense counsel did not state he was happy with it. He was searching for a bench book definition, which the military judge himself said, I can assure you there's nothing in there. And so what we would, for there to be a waiver, there would need to be an express unequivocal statement from defense counsel for that to count as waiver. And I think it's fair to characterize defense counsel's response of no objection, there's nothing in the bench book. It could be equivocal, but even if this court decided that there's enough of a discussion on the record to say there's waiver, just for the definition of in the presence of, then that leads into the prejudice analysis for ineffective assistance of counsel. But
let me ask two more questions about that. One is, specifically, how is this case distinguishable from Davis? I mean, maybe we have to overrule Davis 2020 for you to win, mm-hmm. but can you explain how what was said here is distinguishable from what was said in Davis, if it is distinguishable?
Well, we're actually dealing with two different instructions in this case, Your Honor. And so in order for there to be a waiver, there has to be a discussion of the issue on the record. And if there's no discussion, if there's no clear record, then there's no waiver. So we would, which this court actually acknowledged in Rich, pointing to Davis as being unclear, and that was in the Rich case, the court noted that at 79 MJ at 477. So we have the some discussion of the definition of in the presence of, which was prompted by panel members during deliberations saying, hey, you know, we need this definition. But when you look at the mistake of fact instruction, there is zero discussion on the record. And given that it's the military judge's responsibility to instruct on this kind of defense, even if it's not requested by the defense, was there some evidence to support that instruction? And the answer is yes. From JMT himself, and then Michelle testified that she even tried to wake him up, but he remained, JMT remained asleep. So the lack of any discussion on the record relating to the mistake of fact, that goes into the second point, why the lower court's ruling was incorrect in applying waiver, because mistake of fact goes to the separate mens rea element of intentionally, not the, you know, whether, not to the definition of in the presence of.
So, counsel, just
one follow-up question. Mm-hmm. If we would apply forfeiture, how can you show that the error was clear and obvious?
So plain error, we look at the law as it was on appeal, and we look to, and then again, this goes into the ineffective assistance of counsel, the prejudice analysis. So we know that there's a reasonable probability JMT would, I'm sorry, Sergeant Schmidt would have been fully acquitted because first you have defense counsel making a legally correct closing argument that it is not a crime to masturbate when you think everyone is sleeping and no one is aware of what you're doing. And that's at JA 222 and 226 through 227. And then in rebuttal, the trial counsel gives a legally incorrect rebuttal argument that physical proximity was good enough for a conviction. And he hammered that point home, that Sergeant Schmidt admitted he made a mistake. Yes, he made a mistake in believing that JMT was sleeping when apparently he was awake. And then three, again, during deliberations, the panel members asked for a definition of upon and in the presence of. And the fact that they asked this question shows they are struggling between two competing arguments, one that's legally correct and one that isn't. And instead of providing a legally correct definition of in the presence of, the military judge told them, hey, you guys figure it out for yourselves, use your common sense, and again, two competing arguments. So if the panel members had been correctly instructed on the definition of in the presence of, and if they had gotten that mistake of fact instruction, those two pieces would have told the panel members the defense got it right, the government got it wrong, and boom, this becomes a full acquittal.
Yeah, I just want to say, to clarify your point on waiver. So you think for the affirmative obligation of the military judge to instruct on mistake of fact, he would have needed to, certainly you would agree if he had said, there's no mistake of fact instruction in my instructions, defense counsel, do you have any objection to that? That would have been waiver, right?
Yes, yeah. Right. So, yeah.
And you've just said if there had been some discussion of mistake of fact in the record, like how would that have come up short of asking that specific question?
Well, it would be like it was in Gutierrez when the military judge is going over the instructions with the parties, and that was a sexual assault case that also involved an LIO of assault consummated by a battery, and the defense had requested a mistake of fact on consent for the sexual assault, and the military judge raised, hey, you know, do you also want a mistake of fact instruction on consent for the assault consummated by a battery? And the defense said, no, sir, I don't want an instruction for that offense.
But it, again, it seems like the rule you're asking for is unless the military judge specifically asks whether or not they want the instruction, there's no waiver.
Correct. So, and again, Your Honor, and if I may complete my answer to your question, when you look at RCM 920 ECHO with the list of required instructions, and you have clauses 1 through 6, clauses 1 through 6 require the military judge to instruct, and those do not depend on a request from a party. And then you have clause 7, which does depend on whether there is a quote-unquote proper request from a party or the military judge raising it sua sponte, but clauses 1 through 6, those are mandatory regardless of a request by either party for that instruction.
Ms. Mitchell, I see your time has expired. Do any of the other judges have questions?
I have something I hope counsel can address when they come back.
Okay.
However you wish, Judge.
Ms. Mitchell, what I'd like you to do on this issue of prejudice, whether this case ends up as a forfeiture case or whether it ends up as an ineffectiveness Strickland claim and resolution, you get the prejudice question. Get to the prejudice question one way or the other. When you come back, could you look at footnote 11 in the lower court's opinion, where they say that what they are using is evidence from offenses that the accused was acquitted of, and they're conducting their factual sufficiency analysis. And then they later say, based on our use of that evidence, we also find there was no prejudice in this case. Can you tell me whether or not, after going through that, whether you think there is an issue regarding the CCA's authority to do so under their Article 66 review powers? Does that make sense?
Yes, Your Honor. Would you like me to address that now or in rebuttal?
No, because we got you know, we're on a time schedule here. Chief Judge is beyond me here. So please, when you come back.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor, I can do that. Thank you.
Lieutenant Flynn?
Yes, Your Honor. Good morning, Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, and may it please the court. I'm Lieutenant John Flynn, and along with Lieutenant Colonel Chris Flosser, I represent the United States. This court should affirm for three reasons. First, ordinary meaning and statutory context show that presence does not require victim awareness. Second, appellant affirmatively waived.
Can you just speak up a little bit more?
Yes, Your Honor.
With the microphone a little bit closer to you, please.
Yes, Your Honor. So first, ordinary meaning and statutory context show that presence does not require victim awareness. Second, appellant affirmatively waived any instructional errors. And third, appellant was not prejudiced. Turning to the first issue, statutory construction is reviewed de novo, and this starts by looking at the ordinary or natural meaning of words or phrases. And where meaning is subject to more than one interpretation, courts look to context to choose among meaning. And only if that meaning is ambiguous do courts then look to draftsman's intent. Here, the ordinary and natural meaning of presence can be found in Merriam-Webster's as the part of space within one's immediate vicinity. And references to proximity, vicinity, or being nearby can be found in virtually every civilian dictionary, including Cambridge Dictionary, American Heritage, Collins English Dictionary, Random House, Oxford American, Oxford English Dictionary. The only place that you find a reference explicitly to awareness is in Black's Law Dictionary, but even there, the primary definition is the part or space within one's, the state or fact of being in a particular place and time. It's only in the alternative definition that you see close physical proximity coupled with awareness. But when you look to the context of that language, before 2004, you never had the phrase close physical proximity coupled with awareness. And it looks like any references to awareness were in more nuanced contexts, like in presence of a testator for will attestations, or presence of an officer, or presence of the court. As such,
if we do not have an awareness requirement, where does that leave us in terms of prosecution of cases? We could have all these hypotheticals that only a law student would love in terms of scenarios where there is a thin barrier of a sheet between the person and the other individual and so forth. How does that compare to being behind a wall as compared to being behind a door? Does the door have to be ajar, shut, and so forth? If there is no awareness requirement here, why doesn't that give the government a tremendous free hand in terms of prosecuting individuals for lewd conduct and sexual assault of a child?
Yes, Your Honor. And with respect to presence, although there is this physical definition which we're putting forth, there's also the metaphysical definition, which could potentially confuse people. But the way that the statute is written, whether or not conduct is indecent is evaluated by looking at the circumstances. And that's provided in that tail end segment of the statute for sexual abuse of a child of indecent conduct. This is something which the court struggled with in State v. Glotzbach. But there, the court looked at looked at those hypothetical situations and determined that an ordinary juror would not be confused and would not find offenses where somebody was somewhat distanced to actually constitute in the presence of.
So does the following play into the answer to the question or not? As part of it, it says conduct is indecent only when, quote, it amounts to a form of immorality relating to sexual impurity, which is grossly vulgar, obscene, and repugnant to common propriety. Is that something you're factoring in terms of your answer or not when we're dealing with the issue of awareness and proximity?
Yes, Your Honor. And the United States position on this is that if awareness is to be considered, it shouldn't go towards presence. It should go towards that, the tail end of that statute, that repugnant, vulgar, obscene language. And that exact same language was used in indecent conduct and analyzed by this court in United States v. Rollins. But there the court determined that that language noted a review of all the circumstances. And just like the court in State v. Bryan considered the language within the context of the rest of the statute, so too here.
So is Rollins the safety valve for a scenario where service members who are married or in cramped quarters have an infant in their bedroom as they have sex? Is that the safety valve to prevent overreach by the prosecution?
Yes, Your Honor. That is the safety valve. And although there are these hypotheticals which present a parade of horribles, that's something which, as I previously mentioned, was addressed by the court in Glatzbach. Now, furthermore, even if this court does find that there is ambiguity, this court can take the approach taken in both Glatzbach and Stevenson that the language which Congress selected, meaning selection of the broad term presence, was intent for broad application.
Well, you focus in your brief almost exclusively on the definition of lewd act in the statute, right, which says certain kind of acts that are done with or in the presence of a child. You talk a lot about there's nothing in there that suggests any awareness. But I'm confused. What work does the word upon do then in the statute? So it says any person subject to the chapter who commits a lewd act. We've already said a lewd act requires with or in the presence of a child. And then it says upon a child. So is upon a child completely redundant to the definition of lewd act, or does that do some work?
Yes, Judge Hardy. With respect to the word upon, we agree with the lower court's interpretation that was essentially subsumed by the language of with or in the presence by.
So it does no work. It's just completely redundant to the definition of lewd act, which also appears in the statute.
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct.
But do you know where, like, I think it's strange. Like, if we look back at the old Article 134, Indecent Acts, there were two sets of elements. One set of elements was for acts done with physical contact. And the verb that it used was a certain act upon or with the body. And then there was another set of elements for no physical contact. And those were acts done in the presence of. It seems odd to me that given the choice of two sets of elements, Congress chose the verb upon from the more restrictive set of elements and put that in the new statute rather than just saying in the presence of, which they certainly could have done, and you're arguing is what they intended to do. Why then carry the verb upon into the new statute?
Again, Judge Hardy, we do believe that the definition does subsume the word upon, but to the extent that upon has meaning, it means on a child, meaning towards a child. And there are multiple ways to get there. It's either with or in the presence of a child. Either way, even absent awareness can still be perpetrated upon a child, Your Honor.
Isn't it possible that you just said upon a child, toward a child, for there to be harm toward a child? Doesn't that possibly mean that the child needs to be aware? If the child's completely unaware, is there been an act upon a child?
Yes, Your Honor. If the child is unaware, the act can still be done upon the child, particularly if there's some kind of contact, but even without contact, if it's in the physical presence of the child, meaning that the child is physically located there and he could wake up about it and find out about it after the fact, cases like that still present serious risks, as was referenced by the Sixth Circuit in the United States v. O'Neill.
And so essentially we create a strict liability crime because of the potential that there might be harm if as the Sixth Circuit discussed in its case, whether the child wakes up or otherwise becomes aware.
No, Your Honor, it's not a strict liability crime. It's a general intent crime. The actus reus, meaning the indecent conduct, must be intentionally committed. But those other terms, such as with or in the presence of, those need to be basically evaluated as attendant circumstances.
Well certainly the act needs to be intentional. All acts are intentional in a sense. But the harm to the child doesn't need to be intentional.
That is correct, Your Honor. So appellant incorrectly relies on Burkhart in appellant's answer, and part of that is Burkhart was interpreting the old statute, but Burkhart also involved a misreading of Miller. So in United States v. Miller, awareness wasn't even at issue, for one. And second, even if there could be an awareness requirement imposed on presence for Miller, it's unclear whether or not that awareness would have to be by the victim or the accused. And also, there's adequate language within United States v. Brown, which suggests that this kind of conduct should be criminalized without victim awareness. As I mentioned previously, there was the quotation from United States v. O'Neill. And as we know from Brown, the purpose of criminalizing indecent liberties was to protect children from actions which have a tendency to corrupt their morals, which masturbating in the presence of a child would have. As such, ordinary language in the context in which this language was used show that presence does not require victim awareness. Moving to the second issue, appellant affirmatively waived any instructional errors by making affirmative representations on the record that he was not objecting to the findings instructions and not requesting additional instructions. Now, affirmative.
So just to be clear, if we were to conclude as a court that your definition of presence is the correct one, that there is no awareness requirement, we would not need to reach issue two and issue three.
That is correct, sir. If you find for the government on issue one, then you do not reach issues two or three. So waiver is the intentional relinquishment of a known right, and whether an appellant waives an issue or waives an issue is a question of law that appellate courts review de novo. Now, in 2017, this court in United States v. Davis noted that waiver in the context of required instructions is accomplished by affirmative action, not a mere failure to object. And that's the situation which was presented in Davis, where there's no indication about whether or not the military judge asked if there were objections to instructions or asked if there were requests for additional instructions. But 2020 Davis is completely different, because there was the specific request by the military judge. And the trial defense counsel there stated, "No changes, sir," when asked if he had objections or requests for additional instructions. And that's the case here. It can be found on page 203 of the joint appendix. It's not like the military judge just surprised the appellant with a question of objections to the instructions. He gave them about a one-hour-long break to discuss the findings instructions at an 802 conference. And after that 10:20 to 11:19 break, then he comes back on the record to give counsel an opportunity to object, and he specifically states, "Do counsel for either side have any objections to the findings instructions in their current form?" Appellant states, "No, sir." And then asks if there are requests for additional instructions. And appellant states, "No, Your Honor." Now, waiver, just for the phrase "no objection," has a lot of support in previous case law. Outside of the instructional context, we have cases like Ahern, Swift, Campos, and Haynes, where statements of "no objection" were sufficient to waive issues. And in the instructional context, we have cases like Rich, Smith, Mundy, and Wall. Wall, of course, was the First Circuit case which this court cited in its 2020 Davis opinion. And in that case, counsel's statement of "no objection" at a sidebar conference was enough to waive objections to instructions having to do with causality. But by far the most on-point case is United States v. Gutierrez, because there, the Gutierrez appellant made claims similar to this appellant's claims, which is that mistake of fact was at the heart of his case, and he had simply acquiesced to the military judge's instructions. This court found that the statement, "I simply do not want to request an instruction," constituted waiver. So too here. Ultimately, the 2017 and 2020 Davis cases don't conflict, because affirmative acquiescence is merely one way to affirmatively waive an issue. And that language, affirmative acquiescence, wasn't just pulled out of thin air back in 2020. This court got it from the 1953 case from this court's predecessor, United States v. Smith, where acquiescence was one way to waive an issue. As such, this is a case of contemplative speech and action, and appellant affirmatively waived any error.
Lieutenant Flynn, correct me if I'm wrong, and correct my memory at least. As I recall, defense counsel's closing argument included assertions to the effect, if you read it in its totality, that one could conclude that some of what he was saying is that my client didn't know or may not have known that the victim was awake. Now, if that's the case, and they have this 802 conference, and they all talk about the instructions, and then they come back on the record and the military judge asks, are there any additional instructions we need to consider or that you need to request? And counsel says, no, there aren't. Is that the situation we have here? Is that kind of what you're arguing here? And again, my question is based on my maybe faulty recollection of the counsel's closing argument.
Yes, Judge Sparks, that's correct. That's the situation.
Oh, I thought you were going to say yes, so my memory is faulty.
Oh, no. No, Your Honor, I would not say that.
All right. Thank you.
But in the situation, the question is, you know, was it known right? And here we had the proposed instructions, which were submitted ahead of time. An affirmative defense of mistake of fact is one of the most well-known affirmative defenses that exists. And while that statement, that argument by trial defense counsel could somehow indicate he was arguing mistake of fact, it could also support that he was arguing against that the tail end element of sexual abuse of a child, that grossly vulgar, obscene, and repugnant language, which must be reviewed under a considering all the circumstances. Moving on to the third issue, appellant was not prejudiced by presumed deficient performance because there's no reasonable probability of a different result. Claims of ineffective assistance are reviewed de novo, and here, even if the members were instructed that presence required victim awareness, there was still the testimony by the victim that he was aware of what was happening, and there was also the testimony by the victim that the appellant had touched his back. And in response to having his back touched, the victim slid off the air mattress to the left. So this would show some kind of reciprocal awareness, and appellant would have known that the victim was aware of his contact. Furthermore, there was no evidence of mistake of fact here. Now, because this is a general intent crime, there has to be both objective and subjective mistake of fact. And while appellant argues that the victim testified that he pretended to be asleep, and Michelle testified that she thought the victim was asleep, and somehow that supports an honest mistake of fact, the court cannot take objective indications of mistake of fact and bootstrap them into subjective mistake of fact. And for the authority on that case, it wasn't mentioned in our brief, but United States v. Willis, it's 41 MJ 135. That was this court's case from 1995. Where objective indications of mistake of fact cannot be used as subjective indications of mistake of fact. Additionally, while appellant does note that this NCIS interview contained a head nod by appellant, when you actually watch that entire interview, which is in Joint Appendix 258, and I believe the head nod is at timestamp 10324, this doesn't seem to be an affirmation. It seems to be more of a conversational formality. And more than that, it looks like he's nodding to the statements, I'm just going to masturbate to try to go to sleep. He's not nodding at the moment that NCIS is saying, this kid's sleeping. But regardless, even if there was some evidence of mistake of fact, as noted by the lower courts, the central tenets of the victim's testimony went unrefuted. We have the fact that the appellant is the one that suggested the victim's brother sleep in a separate room. The appellant also put his hands on the victim's back, and the victim moved in response to that. We have Michelle's corroboration of the victim's testimony when she observed that he was to the left side of the air mattress. Furthermore, the appellant's version of events in Joint Appendix 258, that NCIS interview, is entirely uncompelling. And the reason is that when you look at page 266 of the Joint Appendix, what you'll see is that air mattress is almost immediately adjacent to those striped chairs. So if you were to believe that appellant went on those striped chairs and masturbated, and that he didn't think that the victim was awake, well, he was practically right on top of him. You know, it just looks like maybe 1 to 2 feet away from him. Furthermore, he says that he threw a red blanket with ejaculate onto the air mattress. But that would have meant that he would have had to throw that red blanket with ejaculate over the victim and onto the air mattress. In other words, it was very clear.
Did the appellant have any defense other than his mistake of fact defense?
Yes, Your Honor. And his defense and what he argued was that the victim was basically fabricating the allegations in order to get attention.
But, I mean, it certainly seems like he made sufficient admission. It doesn't really seem like a lot of the facts are in dispute about what he did. And given that, I don't really know what other defense he had other than his mistake of fact defense.
Right. There was a lot of criticism about the victim. That seemed to be the main way that the defense attacked this case. And I believe that they also had a credibility of the witnesses instruction as part of the instructions given to the jury. And, Your Honor, if I may briefly conclude.
You may.
Ultimately, the appellant also never stated in his interview that he thought that the victim was asleep. For the foregoing reasons, the United States respectfully requests that this court affirm. Thank you.
Ms. Mitchell.
Thank you, Your Honor. I would just like to make a few points. First, Judge Sparks, in response to your question about footnote 11. So a court may consider facts relating to the acquitted offense in reviewing legal and factual sufficiency. But what the lower court did that was wrong was then they assigned a certain weight to be given to this honest mistaken belief that JMT was asleep. And in keeping the weight that they assigned in evaluating instructional error, that was the wrong thing to do, because when you look at, you know, whether an instruction is required to be given, the standard is only if there is some evidence, not whether that evidence is thin or thick or direct or indirect. It doesn't matter what the source is. It doesn't matter which party puts it into issue. On a scale of 1 to 10, if something is a 1, that is more than a 0, and the military judge is required to instruct on that issue. So going to Judge Hardy's questions, and the government is just flat out wrong in saying that lewd act upon a child is a general intent offense. It is a specific intent crime. So you have the general intent to commit the actus reus, which is the masturbation, but again, in Congress changing indecent liberties to lewd act upon a child, they changed it into a specific intent crime that required Sergeant Schmidt to intentionally harm JMT with his masturbation. And so if JMT had been asleep, again, there's no sensory perception and therefore no awareness of appellant's conduct, which means there's no presence, which means at best this would be indecent conduct under Article 134 UCMJ, which did not go into effect until about 3 weeks after this particular incident. And historically, CCAs, in dealing with a conviction for indecent liberties with a child involving a child who's unconscious or asleep, the lower courts have set aside those convictions and then affirmed an LIO of indecent acts, typically with another. But that can't happen here because, again, indecent conduct under 134 did not exist. So, and that's why this court has to set aside the findings and sentence and dismiss with prejudice.
Since your time has expired.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Do my colleagues have any questions? If not, then that concludes oral argument. The case has been submitted. Court thanks counsel for both sides, and the court will be in recess until 10:45 a.m.